Chapter 16. All Clan Conclave. The Conclave begins. The Seaborn delegation was the last to arrive. Word of the Conclave reached the clan's islands off the northwest coast of Cadellium via a four-man sailboat. They crossed the separating strait under cover of darkness to avoid Narthani sloops and the cutters built in Preti after the Narthani took control. Even the cutters, with their 6 12-pounders, were a danger to any clan boat, none of which had ever been armed. Once the Seaborn headman received the Conclave summons, he and those he brought with him had to cross back to Cadellium on the same craft that brought the news, again avoiding Narthani vessels. Once ashore, they had a 3-day ride to Oro City. Some clan parties had waited 3 days for the last delegation, so when Seaborn arrived 2 hours after sunrise, all of the delegations were summoned to begin. Seaborn would rest that night. It took an hour to gather all of the delegations, and as soon as the last one, Nivax, arrived at the Conclave Hall, Headman Oro stood at a low dais and struck the 2-foot ceremonial gong that called all attendees to attention. 18 hetmen and 73 accompanying advisors slowly ended their side conversations and turned their attention to Oros.
Hetman and sirs, this all-clan conclave of Cadellium is called to order. All 18 free clans are present. The only topic for this conclave is the Narthani threat to Cadellium and what the clans intend in response.
Before Oros could continue, Hetman Nivax rose and called out,
"A point to discuss before we continue, Hetman Oros. When all 21 clans were in attendance and a vote was taken on any issue, it took 18 supporting votes before a decision was mandatory on all clans. Since 18 clans are here today, then all 18 must support a mandatory decision."
Groans, sighs, and calls filled the room.
"For God's sake, Nivax, sit down. Nonsense. When would any vote ever be unanimous? No, it must be 15 out of 18. We can't include the 3 Narthani provinces."
Nivax wouldn't be shouted down.
"If the vote is not for all 18, then that violates the written rules of the Conclave, and Nivax will not follow any decision made with fewer votes."
"Nivax will comply with the will of the Conclave or be subject to expulsion," said Oros, his voice icy, the ultimate threat laid bare.
Nivax started to say something, but a gray-haired advisor sitting behind him grabbed him by his sleeve and whispered in his ear. Nivax sat down, glaring at Oros, who let the responses continue for almost a minute, then struck the gong again. It took an additional blow to quiet the room.
"Hetman Nivax has a point," Oros said. "The written rules of the Conclave are clear. It mentions 21 clans and makes no provision for fewer. However, rationality demands we adjust to the current conditions and reduce the needed number. Are there proposals for how this might be done?"
Almost 30 minutes passed to settle that it would take 16 votes out of 18 clans for a binding decision on all clans. Kullish had hoped for 15, but Nivax persisted in 16, and enough other clans felt leery of being forced to abide by decisions that the more difficult number prevailed. It would take only 3 votes to block action. The vote number determined, Oros moved for the second time to formally open the conclave.
"All 18 free clans are present, and with the agreement that a binding decision requires 16 supporting clans, this all-clan conclave is open. There is only one topic, and that is the Narthani threat. Hetman Keelan will summarize where we stand at this moment. Questions will wait until he is finished."
College took the next hour to overview the history of the Narthani presence on Cadellium, starting with their first trading station on Preti. through crushing Predi, co-opting the Aiwal and Selfsil clans, carrying raids either through Baldorian mercenaries or their own forces, and ending with the invasion of Moreland. He made particular note of Selfsil's rejected appeal for help at a previous conclave.
Thank you, Hetman Keelan. Are there questions?
Although everything Kulloch said was known to everyone in the room, it took another hour to finish with questions and clans such as Nivax and Skooks trying to interject opinions, efforts quashed by Oros as premature. On two rare instances, certain hetmen asked reasonable questions to clarify history where ambiguity existed. When Oros ruled the questions had been sufficiently answered, and with no objections, he adjourned the conclave for a midday meal, which waited on tables outside under tents. An hour later, they began again. Oros struck the gong.
The question we have before us is, what action should the clans take to deal with the Narthoni?
Seven hetmen rose to be recognized. Oros had arranged with Stent that he would be recognized first. Oros wanted to keep the session focused on the main issue and not let clans such as Nivax cause diversions.
Hetman Stent, Oros intoned. What say you?
Wellman Stent waited for the other six hetmen to reseat.
Fellow hetman, I see three possibilities. One is to accept that the Narthani are a permanent presence on Cadellium and to do everything possible to restrict them to the three provinces they now control. The second possibility is to drive them off Cadellium by force. The third is to do nothing and pray to God they take no further action against other clans.
Oros had to ring the gong a dozen times before the tumult died. Stent's third option was quickly dismissed when Hetman Farkesh reminded two hetmen who seemed inclined to favor that option that men may pray to God, but God expected men to act.
And not be like a stupid Neslander Merver and close your eyes, hoping danger thinks you're not worth its time.
The large flightless bird was originally found in western Cadellium thickets and was renowned for freezing and relying on camouflaged plumage to escape predators' notice. The first possible action proposed by Stent could not be easily rejected. Hetman Powell was recognized.
Who is to say that if we leave the Narthani alone, now that they lost at Moreland City, they won't realize taking over the rest of Cadellium will be too difficult? They're like the hornet's nest, best left alone.
Hetman Paul, said Kulloch,
what do you do if the hornets move and try to establish a new nest in your house?
Is that not what the Narthani have already done? First with Predi, then Aiwal and Selfsil, and most recently their invasion of Moreland?
What do you do if you wake up one morning and find a new nest already in your house?
Do you live with them and hope the nest doesn't proliferate? Or do you take whatever action is needed to remove the first nest?
No. All of us here would take action. Hetman Pewitt rose.
I appreciate your analogies, Hetman Keelan, but we have to balance the perceived threat and the costs of any action we take. What if we simply wait and see what the Narthani do next?
What if their next action is to attack a clan from the sea? Asked Stent.
We stopped them when they came inland, but they also gave us time to gather the clans. Remember how they moved slowly and then waited in place for several days when they neared Moreland City? They obviously wanted us to gather so their army could defeat us in battle. They won't make that mistake again.
They could directly invade Gwilymor or Stent, moving fast and with the support of their navy. Before other clans could come to those clans' aid in enough numbers to stop them, the Narthani could have burned every structure in the province to ashes, killed or run off all animals, and killed or captured who knows how many of the province's people.
I agree with Stent. They don't have to do it by land, interjected Adris.
With their complete control of the sea, they could land thousands of men, cannon and horses on the shores of any clan on a coast. No one clan could stop thousands of Narthani from destroying the province before more clans came to help. Even if clans did come, as soon as the Narthani felt their men threatened, they could just reboard their ships and go elsewhere to attack a clan on the other side of Cadellium. Maybe a clan whose men were sent to help the first clan. Stent rose again. Each headman needs to ask himself what he and his clan would do if the Narthani invaded, either by land or by sea, and moved quickly. Headman Skooks, what would you do? The rough-looking, scared headman with long gray hair appeared grim.
I pray to God I would act wisely and not waste the lives of my clan's people in a futile fight. If necessary, we would flee inland to the mountains, where we would fight until the other clans came to our aid.
A wise decision, Hetman, said Stent. However, what happens to Skavona? I've been to your capital. It has some of the oldest buildings in Cadellium and is unique. The Narthani would burn it to the ground.
What of the other towns and villages? How many of them would suffer the same fate? And your animals? Would you have time to drive all of them to safety, or would you have to focus on saving the people and leaving the herds to the Narthani?
The Skooks Hetman's face became even craggier, as his jaw clenched and unclenched.
Then we would rebuild Skavona better than before, and animals can be replaced.
Yes.
And I'm sure your people would try to endure the consequences. But then, what if you rebuild and the Narthani come again and repeat the destruction? How many times could your people endure such a cycle?
Skooks didn't respond. And you, Hetman Swavebroke? What would your people do in such a situation? Would you abandon Shulluk, your capital? And one of the largest cities on Cadellium?
We would defend Shulluk until help could arrive from the other clans. Although their army might be too much for us in the open, it would be different among city streets, where we know every corner and turn.
Two of the six men sitting behind the Swavebroke Hetman shook their heads and the six murmured among themselves. Stent pressed harder.
What if you couldn't stop them before help arrived, if it arrived? What then for the people of Shulluk? You would be gambling with their lives to think you could stop the Narthani.
Swavebroke's confident expression melted into desperation.
Then what are we to do? Neither Shulluk nor any other town in our province has mountains to fall back to for protection. Thousands of my clan's people might be captured or killed if the Narthani landed their soldiers and we tried to flee, no matter how bravely our men tried to slow them in the open country. Yet how could we abandon Shulluk and move our people away from the coast?
You should stand and fight them to the death. That's what you should do,
scolded Eldon Van Dinka.
Better all should die than end up slaves of the Narthani.
Easy for you to say, Van Dinka,
said Terras Bolteki, the Bolteki Hetman.
Your clan and mine have no coasts. Southern Narthani can get to us without first going through other clans. And we have plenty of mountains to hide in. If anything, we would be among the last clans overrun by the Narthani.
But make no mistake, if the others fell, our turn would come.
You talk bravely about dying.
But what about the children? Do you decide their fate so easily?
Oros held up his arms.
I think we can get back to what we should do.
No one doubts the threat the Narthani pose to all of our clans. However, we have to do something.
Could we try to negotiate with them?
Asked Milton Earnmore, the Pewit clan hetman.
I know it's something none of us want to do.
Even if what we want is to have the Narthani gone from Cadellium forever, we have to face all options, one of which is the first possibility Hetman Stent listed. If we could come to an agreement with the Narthani that we cede control of those three provinces, would they be willing to leave the rest of Cadellium alone?
College stood. Milton, while I understand your desire to settle all this with as little additional bloodshed as possible, and with the security of our clans assured, how could we ever trust the Narthani to keep such an agreement? They will do anything necessary to further their goals. Look at the two assassination attempts. Hetman Stent was fortunate to have enough armed men nearby to foil the attempt on him. Lordium Huel also survived, but only because the assassins mistook his brother for him. Consider how they brought in the Buldorians to raid and kill and then continued with their own men. Look how they turned the Iwalese loose onto Moreland, burned two towns, and killed over 600 Morelanders. Can you honestly say you would trust them?
No, College, there's no way I'd trust them. But what is the harm in at least trying to have representatives meet with them? The worst that would happen is they refuse to meet. Still, on the slim chance something positive may result, shouldn't we try? Maybe it would make them pause if they're planning further attacks.
College didn't respond. He saw the conclave slipping away from united clan action. He believed the argument to try negotiating, while rational on the surface, had no chance to succeed and would only provide an excuse to do nothing while waiting for the outcome. Months could slip by, months he intuited Cadellium didn't have. 2 hours passed with the Hetman arguing back and forth, stating and restating reasons to act or do nothing, and repeatedly returning to the negotiation proposal. College limited his participation and waited for the next break, which would come just before dusk. The men would eat, the clan delegations would talk amongst themselves and with other clans, and all clans would reconvene for an evening session. He needed to get ready for a last chance to influence the direction of the conclave. When they reconvened, Oros rang the gong to gather the men's attention.
Hetman Keelan has asked to speak.
College rose, walked to the front of the room, and faced the room full of men.
I will yield to someone who has played an important role in fighting the Narthani. Some of you have met him, others have not. Though you know of him. He has unique perspectives on what we face, and I have asked him to speak to the conclave.
College motioned to the Keelan delegation.
Josef Kolsko.
College had told Josef he might be called on if necessary. They needed to bring the clans back to facing the imminent threat of the Narthani. Josef had spoken to a group of hetmen and others previously at the end of the Battle of Moreland City. However, at that time his head throbbed from the wound whose scar he carried, and his body was coming down from the physical and emotional consequences of having survived the fight. Thus, he hardly remembered what he had said. Though Dennis told him he had warned that the Narthani had merely withdrawn, had not been defeated, and were still a threat. Today was different. Both conscious of the setting and aware of the stakes, Josef didn't feel optimistic. Everything he'd heard so far showed that too many clans still hoped to avoid becoming involved and still remained incognizant of the level of the Narthani threat because it hadn't yet impacted their clans. Nevertheless, he had to try. If nothing else, perhaps something he said would influence them later when they remembered it. At least there had been good news. A semaphore message had arrived from Kernford the previous day. It took the station in Oros City several hours to track him down, the station assistant explained, as he handed Josef the folded sealed sheet.
Not sure what it means, Sir Kolsko, said the assistant. Sounds like gibberish. Tell me if you want us to ask Kernford to resend the message tomorrow.
No secrets could be kept from the Semaphore station staffs. Thus, Yosef had cautioned against sending information too sensitive in case an Arthani agent had been placed at a station anywhere on the island. This also limited loose lips that couldn't resist spreading titillating news. Yosef had broken the seal and read. To Yosef Kolsko, from Mera Kolsko Keelan, news from Yawnfall. Success 6. 10 test okay. Triple burst. Mounting and 5 more. He was sure that it meant that Yawnfall Nifork, the foreman of the Abersford Foundry, had reported the successful casting of a 6-pounder cannon barrel based on 10 successful test firings without damage to the barrel and it taking a triple charge to burst the barrel. They were proceeding to mount the barrel on a carriage and would cast 5 more barrels. He had told College the news and let the headman decide whether to tell the others. For now, he faced the room full of bearded faces. Yosef remembered being nervous on boarding the flight from San Francisco to Chicago, but that was because of flying, and not at the prospect of presenting his research results to a room full of hundreds of scientists and engineers. He knew he would speak about a topic he had supreme confidence in, his chemical research and its implications. He could remember giving talks in undergraduate and graduate seminar classes on topics new to him and how petrified he felt the first few times, although it gradually became easier the more he did it. For the Chicago meeting, it was a topic he considered himself an expert on. Now, he would be talking about subjects on which he remained a dilettante. He feared leading astray this room full of leaders. Yet here he was, facing clan leaders, most of them older than he was, most having many years of responsibilities beyond his experience, and he faced them ready to launch into what he believed they needed to hear. He couldn't control whether or not they understood. He cleared his throat and did his best to look calm, confident, and wise, a troika that seemed, respectively, true, false, and in the realm of in your dreams. Hetman and sirs, I stand before you as someone not originally from Cadellium. I came to your island unexpectedly 3 years ago, and now consider myself a Cadelli, if only by adoption. Wherever my origin, now my life, my future, and my family are irrevocably tied to the same fortunes as your own. I believe I bring a different perspective than most of you, one built on the history of my own people and the histories I have read of other realms. Many of those histories are apparently not available here in Cadellium. Therefore, I consider the Narthani problem from that background. The first thing I would ask you to consider is simple. Why did the Narthani come to Cadellium? The island is not on trade routes, and while the island has admirable natural resources, they aren't enough for the Narthani to spend the effort so far from their closest port. Although I have no way to be positive, it comes to me that the Narthani plan to use Cadellium as a base to attack Landolin or the Iroquina Confederation, perhaps both. Yosef had deliberately chosen to use the phrase, it comes to me, to play into the Septarsh rumors. As much as he cringed, the stakes were high, and he had to discount his personal qualms. He had no way of knowing that the Keelan, Oro, Stent, and Gwilimer Hetman had casually sprinkled their conversations with other Hetman and their advisors with references to the Septarsh rumors, never giving a firm affirmation, yet leaving the impression they were open to the possibility. His choice hit a nerve, because he thought at least half of the Hetman and many of the advisors sat a little more upright, or their eyes widened slightly at his words.
Whether this is true or not, there is no reason to believe they have any intention other than to conquer all of Cadellium. If you see a storm coming in your direction, do you assume it will pass you by, even if your neighbors are hammered by rain and wind, or do you close your windows and bring your children inside? You've already heard Hetman Ulros refer to the Nestlander Merver. It closes its eyes and hopes for the best. Same with the storm. Who among you would close your eyes as the wind and lightning got closer and not assume you'd come under the storm? The Narthani are coming. When, I can't say, but as sure as the sun rises each morning, the day will come when a Narthani army comes for each of you. Together, you can resist them. But do any of you now think your clan can turn them back by yourselves? It may require working together in ways alien to you, even suborning the immediate interests of your own clan in favor of the many. Likewise, the time will come when the other clans will do the same for you. Imagine a single thin 2-foot-long piece of a tree branch. You can easily break it. Yet bundle 18 of these together, and none of you could break the bundle. United, you can stand tall. Divided, you fall. You will either hang together or hang separately. Yosef paused to let the last line sink in. It wasn't the greatest oratory, but thanks to Ben Franklin again for the hanging quote and the fact that hanging for the most egregious crimes was known on Cadellium. He remembered the bundling reference from once looking up the origin of the fasces, the symbol made of sticks or rods tied into a bundle, sometimes with an axe head protruding from the top side. The example came from an Aesop fable, and Romans adopted it as a symbol of strength through unity. Yosef's curiosity in the symbol's origin stemmed from seeing it on dimes in a coin collection given him by an uncle when he was 9 years old. The mercury dimes had the head of the Roman god Mercury on one side and a bundle of rods on the other side. No one he knew could tell him what the bundle represented, so he asked the librarian at school. She told him the bundle was a fasces and explained the symbolism. It was more than appropriate for what Yosef saw the clans facing. He saw no reason to soil the image by providing further information that Italy's Mussolini had used the fasces as the symbol for his political party, thus giving rise to the word fascism. When the men in the room started to mumble among themselves, Yosef spoke again. Neither I nor the people I come from have personal experience with the Narthani. And I have asked 4 persons who have such experience to come today to tell you what it's like to fall under the control of the Narthan Empire. Yosef had thanked Mara for suggesting that he bring in witnesses, because she believed personal stories would have more impact than general warnings. These 4 persons, Yosef said, escaped from the Narthani and fled into Moreland, Gwilymer, or Stent provinces. He gestured to Dennis, who had moved to stand by the main door in the back of the room. Dennis now opened the door and motioned to someone outside. The first person is Ubeda Dubando Bavalisha, as close as I can come to properly pronouncing his given name, said Yosef. That name had not been used for 28 years before he escaped. The Narthani simply called him slave for most of those years. He is 36 years old. Through the door walked a man appearing closer to 56 years than 36. He was short, his face bearing several scars, and he walked with a pronounced limp. Yet, he walked tall, as if proud of the scars and the limp. At the front of the room, he turned to face the clan leaders, He spoke passable Cadelli, though with a harsher tone than Cadelli's softer vowels.
My name is Ubaldabondo Badalisha. Sokolsko has done well to come that close to saying it right. I took several days of trying before I remember the correct way myself. It had been so long since I spoke my own language, because it's forbidden by the Nathani. Punishment is severe and swift, as it is for any transgression by a Nathani slave.
Badalisha untied his shirt and pulled it over his head. Men throughout the room sucked in their breath at the sight of the scars. Long raised welts, probably from whips. Thin scars as if from narrow blades. Puckered skin as if from burns. And others whose origin could not be guessed. Hardly a square inch of skin remained unmarred. The action of removing the shirt had also revealed Ubaldabondo missing one ear entirely and half of the other, and one hand had only a thumb and two fingers.
I was 7 years old when my people fought the Narthani. I remember how frightened everyone was when my father and one older brother left our farm. I remember all the weapons they carried with them. We never saw them again. We heard a great battle had been fought, and our men died to a man. I remember Nathani soldiers sweeping into our village, forcing everyone to gather in the central square. It was women, children, and old men. They screamed at us in their own language, which none of us could understand. Then they divided us into two groups. The children and some of the younger women were put into wagons, our feet tied to iron rings. The youngest children, those not walking yet, were tossed into the arms of the women and children like me. I held a girl of about 18 months old. From where I sat, I faced the square that held the rest of the people. A Nathani officer yelled something. I didn't know what, and the other Nathani drew swords and cut down everyone left in the square. Sometimes at night I can still hear the screams fading as the wagons pulled away. My last sight of the scene as my wagon turned the corner was a woman wearing a red and yellow dress and holding a baby being cut down. I couldn't see her face. But my mother wore such a dress that day, when she was dragged from our home, carrying my two-month-old sister. We joined wagons from other villages, dozens, then hundreds in a line of wagons that stretched as far as I could see. For 2 6 days we were kept in wagons, barely enough food and water given to keep most of us alive. Our excrement coating the wagon floor and eventually shoved out the end of the wagon by our feet. Many died and were dumped alongside the roads. They took us to Narthani slave markets and sold us into whatever our next fate was to be. In the next years, I worked dawn to dusk in a large cloth weaving shop,
untangling threads within huge looms.
Many other boys like me were maimed or killed by being caught in a loom that suddenly released from whatever had bound its action. When I grew too much to slip within the loom parts, I was sold to a farmer who was harsh, though when I think back, those were my best years as a slave. We had plenty to eat, were not beaten for no reason, and when I was 20, I was given a woman as a mate. She was 10 years older and had had 7 children already by 3 different slave men, 2 of whom had died and 1 sold for a reason no one knew. We were mated for 4 years, and she had 2 more children.
When the old farm owner died,
The son who inherited the farm didn't want to be a farmer and sold it, along with all the slaves. The last time I saw my mate and children was when I returned from a field and saw them pulling away in the back of a wagon. When I ran after them, I was run down by the new master on his horse. My leg was broken, and they dragged me to a tree, tied me to it, and whipped me. The leg never healed properly, and I was sold for almost nothing to a horse breeder, who needed slaves to muck out stables and groom horses. You didn't need to move fast for those tasks. When this master came to Gedalium, he brought me and many of his slaves with him. He took over a ranch in the eastern part of Preti province. We never learned what happened to the previous owner. Besides the slaves the master brought with him, there were several newly made Kideli slaves. It was from them that I learned your language. The ranch was only a few miles from the sea, and another slave learned of a fishing village. One night during a storm, eight of us ran to the village. It was hard for me to keep up with the others, though it was a minor pain compared to what I had already suffered over many years. At the village, we stole a small boat and rowed east. One Kideli told us if we stayed directly east, we would reach Gwilima. It took 3 days. Several times Narthani sloops passed so close, we thought they would surely see us, but they passed on. One of us died, and we finally landed on a rocky shore. We were found by people from a Gwilamese village. I've been living and working in Gwilima province for 2 years. He stopped for a moment. Free for 2 years. The prematurely aged man looked to Yosef, who nodded his thanks. He picked up his shirt, pulled it back over his head, and limped down the aisle and out the door held open by Dennis. Yosef waited until Badalisha was gone before addressing the clan leaders again. The next person is Savrinel Storlini. His experience with the Narthani is different than Badalisha's. Dennis ushered in a tall man about 30 years old, with a sturdy form and a strong stride so different from Badalisha's. Baal was translated because the man spoke no Kideli. Storlini launched straight into recounting how the Narthani had swept aside several nations previously, separating Storlini's people from the Narthani. The other nations had resisted and been crushed. When faced with an overwhelming Narthani army, Storlini's people had surrendered without a fight. The capitulation had saved them from immediate annihilation, but failed by other measures. Storlini recounted how his grandfather and father had whispered at night to him that during the course of 70 years, the Narthani had systematically eliminated any trace of their past culture and language. Storlini was a horse handler and trainer and was formerly a Narthani citizen. But he would never rise to any position higher than he had. The workings of Narthon dictated that those peoples absorbed had opportunities to rise in relation to how long it had been since their absorption. Storlini had felt like a foreigner his entire life. The stories about his family's original people conflicted with what he saw of the Narthon Empire. When an opportunity arose, he took a leap of faith that he might find a better life among the islanders than he foresaw remaining as a Narthani. Storlini didn't speak his family's original language, it having been forbidden for the previous 50 years, nor did he know much about his family's original people, except for a few stories passed on to him at home. The Narthani forbade any written records to serve as memory or rallying points for resistance. In another generation or two, even such small bits would be lost, and it would be as if his original people had never existed. The third speaker was Balwis Preti, Yosef's retainer, translator, and bodyguard.
He told them that he was 18 when the Narthani crushed the belated Preti resistance. Bitterness at the Preti Hetman dripped from his comments, as did anguish over the futility and cost of the rebellion. He described watching surviving men being shipped off as slaves, along with many of the women, including an older brother and sister and his cousins. His father and an older brother died in the fighting. He survived only because his father had ordered him to stay at home to watch over his mother and five younger siblings. When news of the disaster in Preti City came, they feared for their lives and fled south with others in three wagons to a horse ranch owned by his mother's distant cousin with a different last name. During the flight, they were accosted by a Narthani cavalry patrol. In the ensuing fight, they lost the wagon carrying two of his sisters, 5 and 8 years old, being cared for by another woman. Balwis, his mother, and the three remaining siblings escaped and assumed new identities as members of the cousin's family. A year passed before they found out that the captured sisters had been converted to slaves and assigned to Narthani owners in northern Preti province. Another year passed while they hatched impractical retrieval plans before the mother and Balwis gave up, and he declared that he was escaping to free clan territory. He told his mother the only way he saw to rescue his sisters was if the Narthani were brought down, and he would do everything he could to contribute to that goal. The cousin's family had not participated in the distant fight against the Narthani, and the distance further shielded them from the worst of the reprisals and the later influx of Narthani settlers. By showing proper obeisance, they kept the ranch, although they had to breed the horses for Narthani cavalry and farms. The larger number of horses and the lack of Narthani records made it possible for four of the best horses to depart with Balwis on a 150-mile dash from southern Preti up the length of the province, through the middle of Aiwal province, and across the border into Moreland. He left before dark and rode hard, stopping only during daylight. He made it across the border on the fourth horse, almost dead, and with the other three having been exhausted and let loose along the route. When he finished, unlike the two previous speakers, Balwis moved to a chair behind Kalich, in case people had questions later. Yosef let Balwis sit before he continued. The final speaker has great courage to come before you and tell what happened to her. Her name is Una Gower, and she was from Preti. I trust you will show her proper respect. Yosef motioned again to Dennis, who opened the door and again summoned someone outside. A woman of about 22 years entered, wearing a shawl over her head, which she let drop as she turned to face the room full of men. She was brown-haired, of average height, and slender, and she had ancient, tired eyes. Like Balwis and some members of his family, she and her husband had been among the few Preti who survived the destruction of their clan. Due to the happenstance that the husband was at sea from their fishing village on the west coast of Preti province. Her husband owned a fishing boat crewed by other related men. When the Narthani finally reached their village, they tried to accept what they could not change until one too many events made them give up. 6 months ago, a Narthani cutter caught 21 of them trying to sail to Stent province. Una was one of three women not executed. They were sentenced to Narthani brothels for the rest of their lives. The other women had died, wasting away within months, while Una had survived. In an emotionless voice, she described her life after her capture. For 3 months, 6 days a week, she serviced whatever men the Narthani authorities deemed worthy. Soldiers, administrative staff, and then a few Selfsili's collaborators when she moved to Selmore, the Selfsil capital. With the help of sympathetic Selfsili's, she was smuggled across the border to Stent and then on to Oro City, where she had lived the last 3 months. When Hetman Oros heard from Kalich that Yosef intended to bring in three people with personal experience of the Narthani, he suggested Una Gower. When Una started her recitation, there had been murmurings from the male audience, which subsided into silence, then angry utterances. She finished by describing the escape from Helfton, hiding by day and traveling at night to avoid Narthani patrols. Without another word, she raised her shawl again and walked down the aisle toward the back door. She had taken only 3 steps when Wellman Stent rose in respect, followed immediately by his clansmen and several other hetmen and clan delegations. She stopped, startled, then continued. By the time she reached the door, every hetman in the entire room was standing. As the door closed, curses and oaths of death to Narthani rang throughout the room. Hetman Oros let the tumult continue for several minutes, then used the gong to bring back order, at which time Yosef resumed speaking. I hope you all understand the courage it took for Una Gower to stand before you. I also hope that after hearing just these 4 accounts of what the future holds for Cadellium, should the Narthani prevail, you begin to understand the full nature of the cost of failure. I also hope you understand that nothing short of total commitment by every clan, every man, every woman, and if necessary, every child will be required. Yosef looked around the room. The question you have to face is what price might need to be paid. He turned to Farron Bakalax, hetman of the Farkish clan. Hetman Farkish, what price would you pay to stop your clan from ceasing to exist?
Anything and everything, the older man stated savagely.
Hetman Stent, what price would your people be willing to pay to prevent from happening to Stent what happened to Preti, or what is going to happen to Iwal and Selfsil?
They will die to the last Stentese.
Hetman Skooks, what would you do to prevent your 5 granddaughters from becoming Narthani slaves and some sent to Narthani brothels?
The white-haired but still robust and multi-scarred hetman jumped to his feet.
I would do anything!
He roared.
All of them would die fighting the Narthani first.
The room exploded in anger and shouts of defiance. When Thomas Oros finally brought back order 10 minutes later, Yosef spoke his last words.
Although I was not originally from Cadellium, I now count myself as a Cadelli.
Look around you at the other men in this room. Look, and look closely. He stopped and waited. Slowly the men looked at their own clan members, then to clans next to them, and then wider in the room.
Until we defeat the Narthani, what you see are not other clans. Disagreements, border disputes, raids, and old antagonisms have existed between many of you. Think hard, men of Cadellium. Pewit versus Stent, Moreland versus Keelan, Pawwell versus Nivax, on and on. I ask you to consider that whatever differences and conflicts have existed are nothing, nothing, compared to what stands between all the clans and the Narthani. Do not think of the other groups in this room as from other clans. Think of them as your brothers. Brothers. In the mightiest effort ever undertaken on Cadellium. If we fail, there will be no history of Cadellium, no stories to pass on to future generations. It will be as if the people of Cadellium never existed. But if we are victorious, legends, songs, and histories will be known for 1,000 years. The room exploded again. Hetmen and men whose names and clans Yosef had no idea of rushed to hug him, slap him on the back, and pledge death to all Narthani. For a moment, Yosef felt as if he had been in no more danger of injury at the defense of St. Sidran's or the Battle of Moreland City.
It took half an hour for Oros to call an end to the meeting that evening and direct the men to return to continue the next day. Yosef stood with the other Keelanders as the room emptied. He felt almost euphoric. He had stood in front of the room full of Kadeli leaders, and along with help from four witnesses, led the men to an outpouring of defiance against the Narthani. Who would have thought I could do something like this? My God. It was almost like something out of an epic novel, or a scene from Game of Thrones. He chuckled aloud, causing Balwas and Dennis to look at him with raised eyebrows. Yes, they're surprised too, and wondering why I'm amused. His thoughts turned from his own grand performance as Kalish left the cluster of hetmen and walked in their direction.
What do you think, Kalish?
Asked Yosef, eager to hear confirmation that his speech had had an effect. Do you, Stenton Oros, think we can get the clans to unite against the Narthani?
Oh, no. Nothing that grandiose, said Kalish.
Cold water dashed Yosef's elation. Then he noticed Kalish's serene expression, with perhaps a hint of pleasure.
We never thought we could get all the clans together, said Kalish. But several more are leaning our way. I even have hopes that the votes tomorrow will be enough to force the recalcitrant to join some form of action, whether they want to or not.
Kalish noticed Yosef's downcast face.
No, Yosef. You did fine. Actually, better than I'd hoped. Asking questions to individual hetmen at the end about what they would do had an impact. Pewit was wavering and now is firmly behind uniting. Similarly with Bevins, although I've always thought Bevins would be forced to join, if only because they would once Aedris did. The two clans have close ties. More important is Farkish. I was uncertain about him, and now I think there's a good chance he'll support us. If that happens, the two most resistant, Swavebroke and Skooks, will gradually come around. I never had any hopes for Nivax, and Seaborn wouldn't be much help, even if they joined, because they're physically separated by being on their islands. Kalish went on, we have to be patient. The clans can't be rushed into anything.
The voting tomorrow? Said Yosef. What does this do for the chances of not just uniting against the Narthani, but forming a central authority to plan and carry out actions?
Kalish shook his head. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Agreeing to unite is the most we can look for at this conclave. Clans agreeing to submit themselves to a central authority is something entirely different. Yosef started to protest, but Kalish cut him off with a firm grip on his upper arm. I know you think central authority is necessary, Yosef. I tend to agree with you. But even I shrink at the idea of someone not a Keelander giving orders to our men. Clan independence is too ingrained. If it does eventually happen, I think it will need one or more catastrophic events, like what happened to the Preti or Moreland, to shock the Hetman.
Yosef made no effort to hide his dismay.
Giving the other clans time to get their heads out of their asses may mean we run out of time. What happens if by the time they wake up, there are fewer clans to unite? Remember, Kadelium started with 21 clans. Now there are only 18 to fight the Narthani, and it's probably best to think of fewer. Nivax seems useless. Seaborn, too isolated. And who knows what Moreland can still muster. We can only do what we can do, Kalish said. And pray to God.
The room was nearly empty. Kalish had kept his hand on Yosef's arm, and as they walked side by side with the Keelan delegation to the exit, he lowered his voice and leaned to Yosef's left ear.
I haven't given your on-war riding to all the headmen, Yosef.
We have enough trouble here without opening too many new ideas for some of these men. I have shared it with Stent and Oros, and of course the four other clans in our now five-clan alliance. Let's see how tomorrow goes.
Yosef's anticipation of the next day's session was shaken due to Carnegie. The big man had found a pub to his liking, presumably while Yosef and Balwis remained occupied with the conclave. By the second stein of beer, Yosef had summarized his impressions. Balwis added his, then was reduced to a string of curses at the blindness of too many headmen. Carnegie had listened without interrupting.
"That's how it ended, Carnegie," Yosef finished. "We'll find out tomorrow whether the clans will vote on a mandatory united front against the Narthani."
"So what if they do?"
asked Carnegie blithely.
"Huh?"
"Let's say that, unexpectedly, from what I hear you say, all the clans vote to unite against the Narthani. What does that mean? What exactly will they do?"
Yosef stared at his big friend. And stared. His mouth had opened partway to say something, but no words formed in his brain to be transmitted.
"I was going to ask the same thing," said Balwis. "I assume you or Hetman Keelan or Hetman Oros have a plan? Would we gather and attack the Narthani? Raid them to death? Piss on them until they give up, or what?" "Yosef," said Carnegie after several more moments, "were you planning on doing something else with your mouth besides catching flies?"
Yosef's mouth snapped shut, his mind in full motion. What were they going to do if the clans united? He had been so caught up in everything else going on, moving to Kernford, Mara's pregnancy, his projects, the university, trying to maintain his writing and workout schedules, writing on war, and then coming to the conclave and preparing to speak, that he hadn't given thought to exactly what the clans could or should do about the Narthani.
"Well, shit. What are we going to do?" The topic came up this morning and the options proposed by Stent. The third option, do nothing, is so obviously ludicrous. The Hetman can't possibly go that route. Attack the Narthani? How? I don't care how many clansmen can be mustered. I don't see how they can win an open field engagement, and if they somehow manage to, the losses of men would have to be as bad as what happened to the Moorlanders. Nibble them to death? The clansmen outnumber the Narthani, so hit-and-run raids could slowly whittle them away and with hopefully acceptable losses if the clans only do it with greatly superior numbers in any action. That could take time. Many months, a year, who knows? Directly invade Preti province and face the Narthani right in their stronghold at Preti city? I don't see it. If necessary, they'd pull back into defensive positions. Digging them out by direct attack would cost as many men as a field battle, if not more. And who knows if it would work? What's left is a siege. That could take many months. I remember reading of sieges on old Earth that lasted years. The clans couldn't stay together and invest the Narthani positions that long. I think there is only one real option for the near future.
Yosef's eyes focused again on his two companions. Carnegie was long since used to such introspective moments. Balwis hadn't accepted them yet and kept drumming the fingers of both hands on the tabletop.
"Well, are you back with us from wherever it is you go?" Balwis said in a grating voice.
"Just thinking," said Yosef.
"You're always just thinking," said Carnegie. "Are you about to share with us what you were thinking? Or do we have to guess as usual?"
"I think I'll let you guess," said Yosef,
lifting his stein for a long draft.
"I would share with you if I had a clear idea of what I think is our only option.
I need to think it over to be sure I'm not missing something obvious, as I seem to do too often.
Balwas gave a disgusted grunt. Carnegie just shrugged at Balwas.
Either it's a secret, or he doesn't have a plan yet. Be patient, Balwas. It usually comes out okay. Usually.
The next morning, the conclave room filled with the same men. Yosef hoped for better results than the previous day. Yesterday had been filled with uncertainty, whereas Yosef now hoped for a sense of purpose. Whether the purpose was real or a mirage, he would find out. Thus, as Oro's ready to call the conclave to order, Yosef sat behind Kalich and hoped they wouldn't summon him again for a brilliant plan. Oro struck the gong 3 times.
Hetman, sirs, we are ready to begin again. I will state what I believe is the summary of conclusions we came to yesterday. You all, of course, can correct me if I am in error. Of Hetman Stan's 3 options he proposed yesterday, I believe we can dispose of the 3rd. That is to simply do nothing. That leaves 2 options. One is to contain the Narthani in their 3 provinces, by whatever means necessary. We can discuss later how we would do this. The 2nd remaining option is to take the fight to the Narthani in their 3 provinces, with the objective of driving them off Cadellium. Once again, we can discuss how this might be done. I believe those are the only 2 realistic options we have, although there is another action that I believe several clans support. Negotiations with the Narthani.
The Hetman argued for an hour, without the clan positions changing on the 3 actions. Finally, Yosef left his chair and knelt next to Kalich.
It doesn't have to be either or, Kalich, Yosef whispered. The clans are in no position to attack the Narthani directly, but might be with time, training, and planning. I forgot to tell you that Mara sent a message. The cannon foundry in Abersford claims to have successfully cast a 6-pounder barrel. Once mounted on carriages, 6-pounders can accompany horsemen and dragoons to battles, giving our mounted men more power. Also, if it's true the 6-pounder casting worked, then most likely we can move on to 12-pounders and possibly other cannon I have ideas about. All that will take time, though. Maybe in a year, with enough cannon produced and more training, perhaps the clans could consider an attack on Preti. Until then, the borders with Narthani territory should be defended.
Kalich had listened with his head canted to Yosef's mouth, his eyes taking in the focus of the other men in the room. When Yosef first knelt, all of the men were engaged in the general discussion. Within seconds, more and more heads and eyes left the ongoing session and shifted to watch Kalich and Yosef. The noise level noticeably subsided, and Kalich was about to cut Yosef short when his son-in-law finished what he wanted to say and returned to his chair. Hetman Huel had been the last speaker, stating why he thought a direct attack was the only final solution but worrying about cost. Having said his piece, Huel then smoothly segued to Kalich.
"It has been pointed out to me," said Kalich, and many eyes briefly swiveled to Yosef, then back to the Keelan headmen, "that the action options are not incompatible. Yosef Kolsko warned us at Moreland City not to attack the Narthani line directly, because we were inexperienced in this type of battle and against this kind of professional army. This doesn't mean we might not be capable at some future time, but not right now. We also must agree that the Narthani not be allowed to expand from the territory they now control. The obvious solution is to affirm that we will resist with all our might any Narthani attempt to expand, such as they did at Moreland. How we do this would need to be worked out. It seems unlikely they will try the same type of invasion, although we can't be sure what else they might do. While we do this, we can strengthen our total fighting ability and prepare ourselves by training, planning, and gathering whatever supplies and weapons might be necessary if and when we attempt to directly drive the Narthani off Cadellium, which would have to be decided by a future conclave.
Most clans immediately grasped the Keelan Hetman's words as a way forward, and one that didn't require a commitment to try to immediately retake the three lost provinces. After another hour, Oros called for a vote. There were no objections. The formal proposal was for heavy patrolling the borders of Narthani-controlled territory with 1,000-man forces contributed to by all clans encamped near enough to the borders to delay any Narthani, Iwol, and Selfsil incursion until more help arrived.
Kalich said the progress in cannon casting was promising. If it proved true, Keelan would share the technology with the other clans, and he hoped the other clans would follow the lead of the Five-Clan Alliance in developing significant numbers of cannon and trained artillerymen.
Then, said Kalich, when the clans feel they are strong enough,
the option to attack Preti can be revisited.
Oros forestalled further discussion by striking the gong and calling out,
"All Hetman favoring Hetman Keelan's proposal signify by standing."
16 Hetman stood, all but Nivax and Skooks.
"All those opposed, stand."
The 16 standing Hetman took their seats. No one stood.
Oros struck the gong once more. "The vote is 16 in favor, none opposed, 2 not voting. The proposal is approved and is the formal decision of the All-Clan Conclave."
Conversations broke out throughout the room, and although several hetmen signaled to be recognized to speak, Oros plowed on.
"There are several more proposals that need to be voted on. I see that some hetmen wish to speak, but I will invoke my position as Conclave Chairman to push on to other proposals. Otherwise, we'll sit here and talk until the mountains erode into the sea."
The Hetman who wanted to speak subsided and accepted Ulrose's ruling.
"Another decision is whether to attempt to negotiate with the Narthani. This is not to be a binding vote, because such an attempt is not widely supported, though we have no reason to prevent the effort. As an indication of the interest in such an effort, we will now vote."
The result was 8 in favor, 5 opposed, and 5 not voting, because the hetman either had no opinion or saw no harm in trying.
"Since Hetman Pewit and Hetman Bevan seem most interested," said Oros, "I ask them to plan how the negotiating gesture will be made to the Narthani and suggest a composition of the clan negotiating team should the Narthani agree. Hetman Stent pointed out to me that we can't have different individual clans trying to negotiate with the Narthani. All of you should have seen Hetman Keelan's report about the dangers of the Narthani dividing the clans by bribes and promises, trying to set clans against one another's interests. Therefore, I propose that no single clan can be allowed to negotiate with the Narthani, and all such contact represent all the clans. Are there any objections to this proposal?"
Hetman Nivax looked grim but remained silent. The other hetman suspected that Nivax had been in contact with the Narthani in an attempt to gain favorable status if the Narthani took control of the entire island. With no verbal objections to the vote, Oros called it out. There were 16 in favor and 2 opposed, Nivax and Skooks. No clan was to have private contact with the Narthani, with the consequence of expulsion from the conclave.
The next issue leading to a vote was Yosef's warning that they needed a command structure to properly coordinate all of the clans. The sticking point was that it would require any clan to follow directions given by someone who, in some cases, did not belong to their clan. After the first 5 minutes, Yosef had no doubt how the vote would go. The only question was the vote total. It ended up with 7 approving, 5 against, and 6 abstaining. College later assured him the vote wasn't that bad, considering what had been proposed and the clan's staunch focus on independence. The 6 abstentions meant those clans didn't rule it out and could be convinced, just not yet. The 5 no votes meant that only 3 had to be convinced, if time and circumstance provided the opportunity. College had expected the rejection of a unified command, as pushed by Yosef, but there were 2 follow-up issues for which College had garnered support from Oros, Stent, and the other 4 clans of the 5-clan alliance. Hetman Oros recognized College to speak.
"Fellow Hetman," said College, "while we have agreed to attempt negotiation with the Narthani and to aggressively patrol the borders of provinces they control, prudence requires that we prepare if these efforts fail and the Narthani launch more attacks. I can tell you what the 5 clans of the 5-clan alliance intend. Our preparations have several aspects. The first is producing more weapons. When we responded to Moreland's call for help, our men brought with them whatever personal weapons they owned. This is fine for blades, but not for firearms, if future battles against the Narthani happen. One problem is we don't have enough muskets. My own people saw this during the Baldorian raid on St. Sidran's Abbey. Many defenders used crossbows or only blades, whereas if all had had firearms, the outcome would have been more assured. We need enough muskets and pistols to arm every member of every clan with extra firearms for replacements and for when a fighter needs more than one. At the moment, only Clan Metok produces firearms in the Tri-Clan Alliance, and only in limited quantities. Hetman Metok plans to increase production as fast as workers can be trained and tools and buildings are available. Since the main iron deposits are in Metok, the other 4 clans will send workers to Metok to help the expansion and gain experience, should production begin in the other 4 clans. One issue that became apparent is the need to produce a single type of musket and pistol so that the men in the clans can share ammunition and to expedite replacement parts for damaged or non-functional firearms. Keelan was fortunate that most of our men's muskets took the same size ball. We refer to the ball size as the caliber. I've talked with other clans, however, and some of you will apparently field forces using 3, 4, even 6 different calibers. This means that not only will you have to produce different ammunition, but the right ammunition will have to be distributed to the right men at the right time in the midst of fighting. You can imagine the confusion and dangers. Then there is the problem of sharing on the battlefield. A man runs out of ammunition. Next to him is a dead or wounded fellow clansman. If they used the same ammunition, the first man could use that of the fallen one. If not, the only choice would be to abandon his own musket and use the fallen man's. We all know we are more accurate and can fire faster with firearms we're familiar with. We also plan to form firearm repair teams to accompany any large numbers of fighting men. Any damaged or malfunctioning firearm will be repaired on the spot, but this is possible only if the firearms are essentially identical, so that spare parts can quickly be substituted. College could see that most of the headmen paid close attention and several nodded at his points, motions he took to mean they understood and approved. Even more approval became evident on the faces of advisors sitting behind the headmen. The notable exceptions were the disinterested look on the face of Hetman Swavebroke and disdain from Hetman Nivax.
"What about existing firearms in clans such as mine, where there are no standard calibers?" asked Hetman Bevins.
"In your case," said College, "I would advise to rearm as fast as possible and use the same calibers that we use. While it might be possible to replace only the barrels, even the existing firearms are still useful, if only for defense purposes and not in the field, where movement and speed are important.
Should Keelan determine the type of firearm Skooks uses?
Asked Skooks, his brow furrowed and his tone indicating irritation.
It's not just Keelan, Stent answered.
You heard Keelan say their five clans have agreed to this, and I'll announce that Stent will do the same.
As will Oroz and Bulteki,
said Hetman Oroz, with Hetman Bulteki nodding agreement.
I think Farkish will also adopt the same ideas, announced Ferran Bakalax,
Hetman Farkish to the surprise of all.
Farkish was the largest producer of firearms and traded them to the other clans. The province also had the most abundant iron deposits.
I've exchanged letters with Hetman Keelan. We've discussed this idea of Yosef Kolsko's. Even before Moreland City, I could see the logic to it, and our firearm foundries have nearly completed switching to the same calibers as the five clans.
Skook scowled at Farkash, obviously angry that his neighboring northern clan hadn't informed him of the intention, then turned to Kulich.
What if a clan doesn't want to make the change?
He challenged. Kulich appeared unperturbed but resolute. That is, of course, the decision any clan can make. However, if the time comes when the five clans are asked to come to another clan's aid, we'll have to consider the likelihood of the aid being decisive. Not being able to share ammunition would be one factor in deciding to commit our men.
There is another consideration. You know of the swivel guns we used at Moreland City. They were effective, though limited because of their size. We hadn't been able to cast larger barrels such as the Narthani use, the ones called 12-pounders.
I have just learned that in Keelan, we have successfully cast the first real cannon barrel. A quarter of the faces in the room rotated briefly in the direction of Yosef, as did another quarter of the pairs of eyes. Most knew where the swivels had originated, having read reports or heard accounts of the Battle of Moreland City.
But that's exciting news, Keelan! Exclaimed Oroz.
Several other headmen voiced similar approval before Kulich raised his hand.
This was only the first success. We're calling it a 6-pounder barrel. It will be mounted on a carriage to accompany our horsemen, the heavier 12-pounders being more suited to accompany men fighting on foot or in defensive positions. We believe this means casting 12-pounder barrels will also succeed.
All our barrel casting has until now been in a foundry in Abersford, a small town in southwestern Keelan. We are building a larger foundry in Kernford and are working with Metak to build another big foundry there because Metak province has plentiful deposits of copper and tin necessary to produce the bronze for the barrels. We have also been talking with Bulteki about the same, and after hearing the news from Hetman Farkash about adopting the same firearm standards as we are doing, I'm sure we could help Farkash establish cannon foundries.
What about Skooks?
Asked Morgul Skooks.
We also have copper and tin and need to make cannon.
Naturally, we will want to help any clan, said Kulich, his tone full of insouciance.
However, with so much to do, we have to first help the clans working closest with us in all facets of preparing for future Narthani attacks.
We will share cannon with cooperating clans as soon as production allows.
Hetman Skooks' face remained expressionless, and he said nothing more. The inference was clear. Whoever doesn't cooperate with issues such as standardizing firearm calibers can expect to be the lowest priority in receiving technological information on cannon casting. By the other hetman's expressions and side conferring with aides, their responses varied. Some smirked at Skooks's put down, while others felt mollified at the prospect of Keelan sharing.
In addition to weapons production, said Kulich, moving on, we plan to escalate food storage in case harvests are interrupted. We're doing this using deep, cold caves to store grain, cured meats, and hard cheeses.
We're also enlarging the size of cattle and horse herds as fast as we can, and making plans to pull the animals and drive them to inland sites where we can better protect them. Increasing the number of mature animals takes time, but we're making a start on it. We're even working to expand the number and capabilities of the mobile hospitals, such as we used in Moreland City. They saved many lives and allowed faster recovery of many more wounded men than would have occurred had they not been near the battle. Every clan should do the same. Finally, we're trying to train all our fighting men to ride to a battle site and then, if the situation warrants, dismount and fight on foot, as some of our men did decisively at Moreland City. We call such men dragoons. Eyes again flicker to Yosef, though fewer than before. The last thing I will mention is that in case the Narthani invade Keelan, we do not intend to defend Kernford, but plan to have the people move to defendable areas where mountains and rivers provide added protection. Kernford itself is too exposed, with no natural defenses. The city can be rebuilt if necessary, but the people and their ability to resist are all that counts. Other members of the five clans are considering similar plans. There you have it, asserted College. You have already heard that the type of fighting that occurred at Moreland City was different from anything the clans experienced in the past. Large numbers of men, combining horses, cannon, and men on foot. This type of fighting, war, as Yosef Kolsko defines it, is known on the mainland continents, and the nations there are experienced in ways we are not. Sir Kolsko has read many writings on such methods, and he has written a brief summary of some of the lessons learned by other realms. Copies of his summary are available to all interested clans, and Sir Kolsko cautions me that these general principles still require men of reason and controlled temperament to implement. College had told Yosef the previous day that he didn't think it was time to share the summary with all of the clans. Obviously, he had changed his mind. Yosef hoped the clans would read the principles and think deeply about them, while he knew some hetmen would be oblivious to their meaning and application. Still, some understanding was better than complete naivete. Hetman Oros, said College, turning to the Oros hetman and conclave moderator. That's the summary of the plans of the five clans. Oros rose and faced the other hetman. Are there any questions for Hetman Keelan?
There were, and the next hour and a half consisted of a rapid-fire interrogation of the details of College's summary. When the questions petered out, Oros raised a final issue.
Hetman, we have agreed to heavy patrols of the Iwal and Selfsil borders. However, this is the decision of the entire conclave, and not just the three clans with those borders, Stent, Moreland, and Keelan. It is only fair that the other clans provide men to participate in the patrols. I propose that we consider that each clan provides 200 men on a constant basis for these patrols. I suggest that those 200 be rotated by each clan so that no man spends too much time away from his home and work, perhaps 3 weeks. Because of the travel problem, Seaborn could be excused. But we can discuss this with Hetman Seaborn.
Oros neglected to mention that the idea had been plotted with College, Stent, and Yosef. Besides the true argument of fairness to the bordering clans, it kept the other clans actively involved in resisting the Narthani and provided opportunities for men from different clans to gain experience working together. Another hour of discussion passed with a few heated moments. Then Oros called a vote, which was approved by 16-2. Each clan, including the two nay-voting clans, Nivax and Skooks, was obliged to provide 200 men for the patrols. The sun had set, and its last light still competed with the stars, when the conclave adjourned and all ensuing discussions between and among individuals and groups finally ended.
Yosef had mainly listened, until the Keelan delegation remained alone and Kulich turned to him.
What do you think, Yosef? This is your first experience with a conclave.
I'm sorry, Kulich, but even though I didn't know what to expect, I'm discouraged by the lack of progress with the clans agreeing to really unite instead of this piecemeal approach.
Kulich laughed. Lewis grunted, and Dennis covered a grin.
Yosef, this was the most productive conclave I have ever attended among the 30 or more I've gone to, either accompanying my father or as hetman myself.
Yosef looked at his father-in-law incredulously.
My God, what must the others have been like?
Kulich slapped him on the back.
I'm afraid that sitting in conclaves and maintaining composure is a headman duty that my father didn't fully explain to me, even though I saw him do it so many times.
Will there be time to bring the others around?
Yosef asked, worried.
A famous general in the histories once said to a subordinate, "Ask me for anything but time." And another time he said, "Space can be recovered, but time is lost forever."
True, said Kulich. Being a leader also means knowing what is possible and doing the best you can with what you have. Not thinking too much about what you don't have.
Yosef's respect for Kulich's patience rose several notches, but his opinion of the conclave's outcome remained dubious as they ate an evening meal and returned to their rooms.
They would be up and on the road back to Kernford well before the first light.